Hello, everybody. Welcome. Very nice to join you today. And I am very excited to bring you this very wonderful person, Brad Laughlin, who is going to be talking today on the journey from money to love. Brad Laughlin is the executive director of the international nonprofit organization CoreLight, and you can find him at www.corelight.org/BR. This organization is dedicated to fostering outer peace in the world through developing personal inner peace. For 15 years, Brad has participated and taught classes in the transformation of consciousness using innovative ways of helping people awaken during these challenging times. With his partner of 20 years, Leslie Temple Thurston, who is a teacher of enlightenment, Brad is the co-author of two books which focus on the teachings of non-duality as the most profound form of healing. Brad also facilitates journeys to sacred sites worldwide and is the co-founder of Seeds of Light, the Core Light's humanitarian arm serving marginalized communities and AIDS orphans in South Africa. He has a BS degree from Duke University and has attended Yale University's Divinity School. Right now, he lives part-time in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and in Limpopo Province, South Africa. I had the privilege of hearing Brad speak on the topic of money just after my Merging and Money Soul Tele Summit, which was last summer, and I knew I had to bring him to you. What I so like about Brad's take on the topic of money is that he is knowledgeable in both the big social picture of money as well as our own personal relationship to money. So it is with great joy and honor that I welcome Brad Laughlin. Hello, Brad.
Hi, Solane. Thank you so much for having me. What a beautiful introduction.
Oh, it's so wonderful to have you here. I am a fan of both you and Leslie. I enjoy your talks and your transmission enlightenment.
Well, thank you.
Now, as we move into our talk on the journey from money to love, one of the things that I'm noticing is that we are moving out of the age of patriarchy, which is characterized by humanity's learning lessons about the abuse of power, to a new paradigm of heart-centered consciousness. What does money look like in these two eras?
Well, it's a great question. You know, this is the journey from money to love that we're talking about. It is the great turning, the turning of a great age right now that we're going through, a pivotal moment in humanity's evolution. Most everybody that's on a spiritual path who is working with consciousness knows about this. Most people that I talk to, even who aren't on a spiritual path, can feel this. Everybody can feel that something's coming.
Definitely.
Some great shift. Yeah, you know about that.
Yeah.
Sort of like everybody across the board, anybody you talk to, even in the supermarket, or, you know, family members who aren't necessarily on a spiritual path, even my conservative father, everybody knows that something's coming. And so
yes.
We're calling it the shift into the new paradigm of heart-centered consciousness. And I think, you know, to understand what money will be like in this new paradigm, it's important to look at the journey of human evolution through the last couple of ages, of great ages. And, of course, the one that we're in right now that we're transitioning out of is the age of patriarchy, which, as you said, is it's an age that's characterized by humanity learning lessons about the abuse of power. And in the new paradigm of heart-centered consciousness, money is going to be much more about sharing and giving and
mm-hmm.
collaborating And in fact, you know, many people say that we're moving towards a gift culture, and you know, I feel we're quite a ways away from that. But there is there's a lot of evidence right now to show that we are moving in that direction. As the old paradigm dies, as these old systems, including the economic system, crumble around us, and we can all see the death happening, we also see the birth of the new. We can all, if we know what to look for, we can see the birth of these new systems, including new economic systems that are being birthed in the world even as we speak. So I think what I was saying is in order to understand what money's going to look like, I think it would be helpful to look just in general about the evolution of human consciousness through the last few ages.
Sure.
And, and then also I think what we can do is take a look at money in these different ages and sort of, you know, see the progression of where we're going. If you go all the way back to the Paleolithic age, which was many thousands of years ago, I think it was probably 12,000 to 15,000 years ago that it ended. So that in that age, that was the age of the hunter-gatherers, and that age was a time of gift cultures. That's really when the gift culture, I mean, those are some of the earliest examples of gift culture that we know of. And in fact, there are still some people alive today who are living in that era, and we're talking about the Bushmen. I'm calling you from South Africa right now, and the Bushmen are still alive. There are a handful left, not many, but they're still here in South Africa, and there are some that are still alive in Botswana. But literally a handful of people. We're down to not many left. But they live in this Paleolithic culture, the hunter-gatherer culture, and they live in a gift culture. It's interesting to look at. There's a great story from Charles Eisenstein's book Sacred Economics about the Bushmen and their view of money, and he tells this story of how an interviewer, a Western interviewer, was talking with a member of one of these tribes that's left, and he asked this Bushman, you know, what is abundance? What does it mean to be abundant to you, or what is wealth? And the Bushman sort of gave his answer, and the man said, well, does that mean that wealthy person has a room full of goods? Do they have all kinds of things stored up in their house? And the Bushman looked at him and said, "Oh no, it has nothing to do with that. It has everything to do with how much the person gives." It has. Basically, wealth to the Bushmen, to people in that culture, is about giving. It's about how much you're able to give away.
Beautiful.
I found that very interesting. And, you know, if you look at it from a very practical perspective, for those people, it's actually true that, you know, when you give something to someone, there's a reciprocation, and they will give something back, and it's not necessarily right at that moment, but later in the future, if the person actually needs something, then a favor is returned at that time. So really, from a very practical level, the more you give, the more you receive. And of course, we know that to be true if we're on a spiritual path.
Ancient
religious teaching. So in any case, the Paleolithic age gave way to the Neolithic age, and the Neolithic age was the age characterized by the Great Mother. some people call it the age of matriarchy, but actually, if you look at some of the research that's been done, it's not. It wasn't really an age of matriarchy. Archaeologists and anthropologists who have done the research, what they show is that it was a time of equality between men and women. Some people call it a partnership, an era of partnership. Rhianne Eisler, in her book, The Chalice and the Blade, which is also a fantastic book, really talks about this, how there was great equality between masculine and feminine during that age. And women had enormous power during that era. The women were the priestesses. And in fact, the interesting thing about money during that age was that some of the earliest examples of money that we have come from that age. It was very connected to the feminine. Money was very connected to the feminine. If you look at some of the earliest forms of money, they were things like cowrie shells. The cowrie shell, if you look at it, actually resembles the female genitalia. And the word cowrie, cows were also a form of money. And so the name cowrie shell and cow are connected, and they both are derived from this concept of money. If you look at ancient Egypt, the goddess Hathor, who was her, she was characterized by abundance, and her breast milk overflowed and created the Milky Way, and she had the body of a woman but the head of a cow, and so cows naturally were very an important part of that culture, and so also just the word materialistic or the word matter, material, the material world. This derives from the Latin mater, which is mother, the great mother. So you look at this and you see that money was very connected to the divine feminine, and
how did we move away into such a distortion of money losing its sacredness?
Well, that's a great question as well. It had to do with the dawning of patriarchy. There have been books written about how patriarchy was birthed. A number of books. One of the most interesting is the one that I mentioned, called The Chalice and the Blade by Rhianne Eisler. But there are many, many books that have been written about this, and they say that there were tribes from the north that came down into what is now Europe and Western Asia. These tribes came down on horseback and decimated the Neolithic population. These tribes had iron weapons, metal weapons, and horses. And the Neolithic people were very peaceful people. They didn't have any defenses for that kind of thing. So they were literally wiped out by these other tribes who were patriarchal tribes. They brought the sky god with them. And this began a system of patriarchy where the feminine was suppressed. They would, these tribes would come in and kill all the men and keep some of the women as concubines. And, this was the dawning of patriarchy. It actually took, I think, somewhere between 1,000 or 2,000 years for it to happen, but it was a gradual eroding away of this system where money was, considered a divine gift. It was part of the sacred Earth Mother culture. So as the patriarchy was birthed, there was this gradual moving away from that revering of the mother. And eventually, of course, as we know, the last 5,000 years of patriarchy has been about the suppression of women and the suppression of the feminine energies in all of us, men included.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are, you know, sort of at the tail end of this 5,000, 6,000 years of patriarchy, and you know, we're watching it crumble all around us. And I guess there are some important things to talk about around money in the patriarchal age as we look at what is coming, what money's going to look like in the new era of heart-centered consciousness. If you look at money in the patriarchal era, you see that, let's just start with present time. The system, the global system of money based in interest is really the linchpin of the patriarchal paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
It does.
So if you look at the effects of a system of money based in interest, you know, you find these very yang qualities, these masculine qualities, if you will, of hierarchy and competition, and actually some of the shadows that are birthed from this are things like greed and scarcity, and so these are all part of the shadow aspect, I would say, of
yes.
the patriarchal.
It seems that in our current patriarchal system, that scarcity is built into the system.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
That it builds around
interest.
An idea of scarcity.
Yes. Yes, let me say there's so much to say about this. This is one of my favorite topics to talk about, so we could talk for a few hours about this. But there are a few things I could say, you know, in general about it. One is, of course, you know, those of us on a spiritual path know that everything is birthed in consciousness first, and then it manifests in the material world. It's not the other
mm-hmm.
way around. So the scarcity that you're talking about actually comes from the belief in scarcity. That is true. You know, that which we think is what we manifest. That which we believe is what we manifest. So the system of money based in interest that we have all manifested and that we've created here and that we're learning our lessons from right now actually is a system that keeps scarcity in place. It's the system of
mm-hmm.
money based in interest. It keeps scarcity based in, excuse me, it keeps scarcity in place. We could talk a little bit about how that works. I'm not sure exactly what your audience knows and doesn't know. Do you think that would be helpful to go into that a little
bit? I do think that would be helpful. I do think that would be very helpful,
okay.
Brad.
Okay. Well, in general, if you look at the system of money based in interest, it is what you could call a Ponzi scheme or
yes.
a pyramid scheme. And I think everybody
yes,
knows how those
we're
work.
We're living in an age of one big Ponzi scheme in terms of our financial system, aren't we?
Exactly. Exactly. And it's because, you know, you've got a very simplistic version of this. Is let's just say this is a simple story that was actually first told by a man named Bernard Lettier in his book The Future of Money, which is also a fantastic book. And Charles Eisenstein repeats it in the Sacred Economics book. But it's a very generalized story of how this works. And he says that, you know, once upon a time there was a village where everybody was living very comfortably together. Everybody loved each other. They were sharing. They were helping each other. And they didn't have money, they traded in chickens. And so once or twice a week they'd have a market day, and everybody would come out into the town square and do all their trading, but chickens were money. And so, you know, people would be trading their chickens for food and chickens for supplies and that sort of thing. And this was working just fine for a long time, and everybody was quite happy. But then one day a man came into town and was sort of looking at the spectacle of the chickens, you know, running all over the place and escaping from the arms of the people who were trading with them, and said, you know, he sort of was scoffing and laughing at the people. And somebody said, "What's so funny?" And he said, "Well, I have a much better way to do this. You know, if you're interested, you can come and see me over under that tree over there." And so he went and sat under the tree, and a bunch of people came around and gathered around him, and he said, "Let me show you this system that I've invented." And he takes a cowhide, and he stamps out a bunch of round discs out of the cowhide. And he says, "Well, instead of chickens, you use these little rounds, and this represents a chicken, so you don't have to worry about your chicken running away and the chaos that happens on market day. You can just use rounds instead." And they all thought, "Well, that's fantastic. What a great idea." And he said, "Well, here, there's 10 different families in your village, so I'll give you each family gets 10 rounds. I'll make 100 rounds." And so they think it's a great idea, and they're so grateful, they say, "Well, what can we do to repay you?" And he says, "Oh, well, why don't I just come back in a year, and as a gift, you can give me 10 rounds. And what happens during that year is that eventually, you know, one family basically has to go bankrupt. Because if you think about it, you know, 10 rounds basically have to leave the system. They have to go disappear and be given to this other person. And so one family went bankrupt, and eventually what happened over time, as they had to do this every year, was that people actually stopped collaborating so much and stopped sharing so much, and the system of competition started to creep in. And, you know, when somebody's house burned down, people were a little more reluctant to come and help them build back, because they knew they were going to be competing against the next person to have to repay the rounds that were owed to the man from out of town. So, it's a very simplistic illustration, but you can see how that would work.
I can get the real picture of that, how that creates anxiety, how that creates scarcity, how that creates competition.
Fear. Greed.
Yep.
People begin to hoard, right?
Mm-hmm.
People start to hoard their money. They don't want to give it away as easily, you know, because they know they might need it to have to pay back their interest one day. So this is just a simple illustration of how interest works. And, it doesn't go into all the details of how it works, but that's sort of a general.
Right.
So in any case, that's really the system that we're living in right now. And it's actually an unsustainable system. It's a system that cannot continue. What's happening right now is that in order to keep the money going, they just have to keep printing more money. And to keep the system going, this great Ponzi scheme, the bottom of the pyramid has to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And what they're doing, or what we're, I don't say they, I say we, because we're all participating in this. We're co-creators of this. There's no us and them here. We are basically converting all of Earth's resources into money. So the rainforest, the ocean, the fish, the animals, all the virtually anything you can name is being converted into money because it's a resource, all the minerals, everything. Even human labor, all the things that people used to do for themselves are now, they're now seen it modestly. For example, you know, back when we were kids, mom made food. And nowadays, mom doesn't have time because mom's probably got another job to try to earn money, so she has to go to the deli to get the food or buy frozen dinners or, you know, whatever. So we're, you know, and mom these days doesn't really even have time for child care. So child care is also now a commodity. So, you know, virtually all the, so many of the things that we have taken for granted over the years are eventually, they're being created more and more into money. They're being converted into money. And this can't continue. It can continue, but if it continues, you know, we're going to, the earth will cease to be able to support us because we will ruin the earth. We'll cut down the last tree and we'll poison the last river and catch the last fish, as Chief Seattle said. Or actually, excuse me, that's a free proverb.
We can't go back to the Bushmen. I don't think we can go back to that. So how do we move into a new paradigm that incorporates modern world with this heart-centered paradigm?
Well, that's the inspiring part of a conversation. Because there are a few answers I can give you. One, the first one, of course, is what we were saying before, and that is that we need to shift our consciousness. The more people who shift their consciousness around the money situation, around our own personal money issues, the more we will move towards creating what we call a tipping point in consciousness. And then from that place, the world financial system will change and will create something that's more sustainable. We don't have to live with this system of money based in interest. We can live, we can make a new system. We can make a different system. So the first answer to your question, I would say, is to shift our consciousness. That's the first and foremost thing. The more people working on clearing the shadow, we call it, healing the wounded parts of the ego, clearing our own personal money shadows, this is what's going to shift the world into the new paradigm. So there's a whole conversation to be had around that, but the other answer to your question is that there are other money systems that we can use and that, like I said, are actually being used. They've already been birthed, many of these new systems, and they're actually in use around the world, but not many people know about them. And so we could spend a little time talking about what some of those money systems look like.
I would love to plant that seed in people's consciousness of what is possible.
Yes. Sure. Well, let's do a little of both. Do we have time for that?
Yes, we do.
Okay. So some of these money systems, let me think. There's a lot of information. Let me just think how to say this. I'm sure you must know, Solene, about complementary currencies. You've heard of that before.
I've heard of it. I don't know a lot about it, Brad.
Okay. All right. So what we can do is talk a little bit about that. Complementary currencies, or some people call them local currencies, are being used all over the world now. And they're not new to this decade or to this modern times, but they've been used here and there throughout the world for centuries. And so I can give you a few examples of that. Modern times, one of the examples is something called the time bank. Have you heard of the time bank?
No.
Well, there's a time bank in Santa Fe, so you can
get to
know more about it because I know you live in Santa Fe. So
I would love to know more about it. I would definitely love to know more about it.
Well, Well, let me tell you a little bit about the Time Bank. The Time Bank is all over the world, growing faster and faster all the time. You can actually Google it. I think it's just timebanks.org.
Okay.
Timebanks.org. And you can find out more information about the Time Bank. The Time Bank was the invention or brainchild of a man named, now I'm forgetting his name. He wrote a book called No More Throwaway People.
I've heard
and
of that book.
I'll think of his name when we as we go along here. But the way the Time Bank works is that it's a local currency. It's basically the principle behind it is that for every hour that you spend doing something for someone else, you get an hour in your bank account. And then you can use that hour to have somebody else do something for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously the more people in the network, the better, because then you can literally, you know, have any kind of service or goods that you want. And it's a, you know, it's a computerized system, so there's software that goes with it. And what happens is that somebody, you know, there's a group of people who are trusted who run the system, and you know, they basically you keep track of your hours, and you put in for the hours that you are working for. So let's say for example, I have a child who needs tutoring. You come and tutor my child. You get an hour in your bank account, and I get a debited hour from my bank account. And then let's just say you need house cleaning done, so you find somebody in the system who does house cleaning, and you pay them an hour. You get an hour debited from your account, and they gain an hour in their account. And then let's just say I want somebody to cook a meal for me, and or at least let's say I cook meals, so I can, and the house cleaner needs a meal cooked, so she will then ask me to cook the meal, and I'll do that for her, and she'll take an hour out of her account, and I'll get an hour in my account.
I love that system. It's very fair in that each person's hour is valued equally.
Exactly.
We have such a disproportionate valuing system right now in terms of some people's hour is exponentially valued, whilst other people's hour is very lowly valued.
Exactly. And that's the point of the system.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the thing, I've been participating in the Time Bank for a while now. I was on the steering committee for the Time Bank in Santa Fe. And, it's still a process of learning, you know. And so what I found was that a lot of people that I would tell about it, they'd say, well, you know, like somebody who's a lawyer, for example, he would say, I can't participate in that. I can't make a living by earning the same wage that a babysitter earns, you know. And what I found I had to tell them was that, well, it doesn't actually have to work that way. You can be creative with it. It's not a direct translation from the old money system to this new one. It's like learning a language. You know, it's different. It's just a whole different system. So you need to look at it differently and be creative with it. So, for example, the lawyer might want to give 10 hours per month with to people who pay with Time Bank hours,
mm-hmm.
and everybody else has to pay in cash or pay with the national currency. Or he might say, you know, anybody who's a member of the Time Bank can use my services for 10% off. Or, you know, every client
mm-hmm.
can pay me for their first hours with Time Bank, every hour thereafter is with national currency. So there's many ways to do it, and it doesn't have to be exclusive. That's why it's called a complementary currency, is that it's not meant to replace the national currency. It's simply meant to complement it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you need a car, you're going to have to use national currency, or a plane ticket, you're going to have to use national currency. But for your things that you get locally, your food, if you want to buy local organic food, you know, you can do that locally. If you need a plumber, you need goods for your house, you can get all those things locally. So it keeps the wealth within the community.
Mm-hmm.
The money
mm-hmm.
doesn't leave the system, you see. So it's a real balance that happens. And let me just say one more thing about the time bank, and then we need to move on. But there are time banks all over the world now. There's a time bank in Portland, Maine, that's probably the greatest success story in the United States. And they have over 1,000 people, I think, in their time bank, and you can get virtually any kind of good or service that you want there through the time bank. And it's been a thriving complementary currency for quite a while.
Yes. And I love the idea of localization, because I believe we're moving away from this nationalization into more local, locally oriented communities.
Yes, absolutely. It's a balancing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But let's change the subject for a moment and talk about this balancing, because you hit on a really good point. And one of the key things that we are balancing as we move into this new era is balancing masculine and feminine.
Mm-hmm.
And the national currency is what you could consider a masculine or yang currency. And these local currencies or complementary currencies are what you could consider yin or feminine, more feminine currencies. So it's literally, as I see this, as we balance the masculine and feminine inside each of us, we will manifest more of a balance in our currency, in our monetary system, in our economy.
Mm-hmm.
So the way I come up with that is from a book called New Money for a New World by Bernard Lethier and Stephen Belgin. And it's an excellent book. Anybody who finds this interesting should read that book. And the other book that I would just put out there as well, if this interests you, is Charles Eisenstein's book, Sacred Economics.
Yes, I just got it. I've just started reading it.
Uh-huh. Do you like it?
I like it very much.
Yeah. I found that those two books above any others, there are many, many books on money right now, but those
could you
two
say
books
the name of the first
others,
one again?
Yes, New Money for a New World. And the author, it's co-authored. One man is named Bernard Lethier, and his name is spelled L-I-E-T-A-E-R. And the other man is Stephen Belgin, B-E-L-G-I-N. Bernard Lethier is, you can Google him, he was one of the co-architects of the euro. He's an international financier who's won and lost fortunes, and I believe is on a path of consciousness. So he's really looking at money now from the place of consciousness. And
mm-hmm.
he has a lot of very, very interesting things to say. And the ideas that he and Stephen Belgin put into their book are really revelatory. It really opened my eyes. So in any case, one of the things that they're presenting in this book is the idea of masculine versus feminine styles of currency. And the complementary currencies are more feminine because they are much more about nurturing. You know, it's about nurturing the community. It's about connecting,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
connecting with people, creating relationships, you know, building community. All these sort of
yes.
nurturing, mothering sort of qualities.
That's another thing with this old paradigm of money, is we've become so isolated in this competition mode. We've become so paranoid and isolated.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, I guess what I would say about looking at what you're describing here, and looking at the national currency as a masculine currency, we have gone so far to the extreme of yang that we're manifesting its shadow.
Yes.
So, you know, there's such a thing as healthy competition. Competition is a masculine quality and a yang quality, and there's such a thing as healthy competition, but we've gone beyond that. We've gone to the place where it's absolutely destructive, the kind of competition that is seen in the world right now between corporations, you know, in government and politics. It's, you know, it's just off the charts.
Yeah.
So competition, hierarchy, you know, our national currency is created by what they call fiat, which means created out of thin air, basically, from on high. You know, it's like a decision of a person in charge, an authority figure. And,
yeah.
you know, more money is created from that person saying so. So fiat currency, it's a hierarchy. That's also part of the masculine, part of this yang
yeah.
paradigm.
Well, you talk about the shift in consciousness has to – did you? Was there more you wanted to say?
No, please go ahead.
You talk about this shift needing to begin within us, that we need to embrace and look at our own money shadows, and we need to balance our own masculine and feminine. Can you tell us more about how to do that?
Yes.
I know that was probably a big...
yeah, that's a really big topic. But probably...
It is.
If we could talk about anything, it's probably the most important topic, because that's
yes.
where the real change happens. It's by shifting our consciousness that we're going to shift the world into the new paradigm and, you know, help birth something that's heart-centered, that's much more about money being love, you know, money equating to love. So the way we do that is by finding that inside ourselves. And there's so many ways to start a spiritual path these days and to do this work. And for me, and for many people I know, the most powerful way is to do what we call the shadow work. And it's to clear, you know, also called clearing the ego.
Mm-hmm.
So many ways to do that. My spouse.
I have a process that I use with people called Z-point clearing, and it clears the shadow
okay.
aspects out of our consciousness.
Fantastic. Well, that's it. There's so many modalities nowadays. There are just so many. My spouse Leslie and I teach one as well called the Marriage of Spirit, and we have a book about
mm-hmm.
that and a website about that, themarriageofspirit.com. And there are so many people doing, you know, things like emotional clearing work and even just plain psychotherapy or Jungian analysis or family constellations. There's so many ways to do this shadow clearing work. So what we tell people is simply find one that works for you and do it. Doesn't matter what it is or who teaches it. As long as you feel comfortable doing it and it works for you, you just need to do the work. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's about healing the childhood wounding and the traumas that we got from life, from our parents,
yeah.
our authority figures, teachers, siblings, others in our community. It's simply about becoming a whole and complete person and dealing with the mental and emotional limitations and wounds that we've picked up from, mainly from childhood, but also from adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
So just along those lines, one thing I can share with you is that in regards to money, what we've found over the 20-some-odd years that we've been teaching this work is that if a person were to decide to simply focus on clearing their money issues, they would become they would be so close to being fully awakened, realized spiritual beings.
That's a doorway in.
Yeah, because money touches literally everything we can name in our lives, almost everything we can name in our lives. Money has its tentacles into every aspect of life today. And so if we simply start with that, that's a great way in. Clearing our money issues is also a way to manifest abundance in our lives. And that's also an incentive for a lot of people.
Beautiful. Yes, and I know for myself, I have such a passion for this transformation of money in consciousness, and I see them as so linked in terms of
absolutely.
In terms of creating a new world, that money is so linked to that.
Yes, absolutely. There are a number of different ways we could go with the conversation here, and I know we've only got about 5 or 10 minutes left, so let's just see if there's something that comes to mind to share about it.
One thing that I would like to talk about, in your outline you talk about the laws of authentic abundance. Can you say some about that?
Okay, sure. That's actually a good way to go. My spouse Leslie and I are writing a book called Living in the Flow, The Journey from Money to Love. And, you know, we've been doing this for years. We've been writing this book for years, and it hasn't been published yet because it's such a vast topic. We're having trouble consolidating it into a book. But in the book, we outline something that we call the 11 laws of authentic abundance, and also the 7 shadows of money. And so if you want to talk about the authentic abundance piece, I could just tell you, like, for example, about the first law, and that is ask and you shall receive. And, you know, that became really so popularized with the book and the movie called The Secret, which so many people have watched or read. And I can't tell you how many people come to us, take our courses about money and about the journey to the new paradigm, and say, well, I did those things, but they didn't really work. You know, sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. It's about, if you haven't seen The Secret, the movie The Secret, or read the book The Secret, it's really about the law of attraction. And the truth is that that is a very valid thing, the law of attraction. You know, that which you, what you think becomes things. Thoughts become things. And it's true that if you ask, it will be given to you. You know, ask and you shall receive. And all of that's true. But the reason that it doesn't often work for people, you know, it's sort of hit and miss, is that we're only capable of manifesting from our level of consciousness where we're at. So in other words, if you have a lot of unconscious stuff on board and you haven't done the shadow clearing work, that law, the power of positive thinking or the law of attraction, is not really going to work for you, because you've got an opposite unconscious side that's buried and is actually working against you. The unconscious holds all the opposites. So, in other words, if we try to attract, let's just say we're holding a positive thought that we want to manifest a house. Well, until you've done the shadow clearing work and you see the unconscious aspect of that, which is the saboteur, or the part of you that actually would sabotage your efforts to get a house, until you really look at that and say, well, why would there be that part of me? Until you really examine that and see the opposite side hidden in the unconscious, you will not be able to manifest your heart's desire. You won't be able to find fulfillment in your life until you actually do that clearing work. You may be able to manifest.
I believe that so fully, yes.
Yeah. You may be able to manifest the house of your dreams and other greatly desired things in the world, but you're not, even if you can do that, you're not going to find the true fulfillment that you're looking for until you clear the ego, until you make the unconscious conscious. So there are many tools and there are many ways nowadays to do that and to look at the hidden opposite sides, the unconscious sides of these great desires that we hold. I'll just give you one simple way that we offer, because this is something that everybody can do, and that is simply to ask yourself in the moment, what is the opposite of this, and name it. And by doing that, by naming the opposites, you're literally making the unconscious conscious.
Mm-hmm. So simple.
So for example, let's just say you desire pleasure. You know, you want something that's going to give you pleasure, whether it's a house or a relationship or whatever it is, and you're desiring this pleasurable thing, whatever it is. Well, you would ask yourself, okay, what's the opposite of pleasure? And, of course, it's pain. So then you'd have to ask yourself, all right, well, what are my beliefs around pain? You know, do I avoid pain? Am I actually willing to embrace and be neutral about the painful things in my life, or am I going to push that down into the unconscious and avoid it at all costs? And the law, one of the laws of the universe, physical laws, is that the more that we desire something, the greater the fear of that thing is going to pursue us.
Mm-hmm.
So that which we chase, its opposite side chases us. And, you know, all the great seers and mystics and saints throughout the ages have talked about this principle. And if you sort of dive into the mystical aspects of many of the religions, you'll find this teaching. So really, that's a basic principle that one has to examine and unhook and neutralize before you can actually find abundance in your life. But let's call it authentic abundance anyway.
Yes.
I would say the difference between abundance and authentic abundance is that with authentic abundance, you basically have everything you need in your life at any given moment. So you may not have $1 million in your bank account. You may not have a house that's paid for. You may not have stocks and bonds and 401ks piled up. I know so many people that live this way. They feel very abundant, and it's because their needs are met. You know, they have one place to live, a roof over their head, they've got food, they've got their basic needs met, and they're very contented people. And I've found this in my own life as well. I feel myself to be a very abundant person, and yet I don't have huge savings, and I don't hoard, I don't put things away in that way. My spouse Wesley is a clairaudient, which means she can hear her spiritual guides inwardly, and they've given her teachings over the last 25 or 30 years. And one of the things that they taught her about money, which is the way I've tried to live since I've known her for the past 20 years, is to never dam up the flow. That we live in a flow. We live in a flow of abundance all the time. If we could just become aware of it. And the way not to dam up the flow is to give, to be a giver, to practice generosity. And that is, I would say, maybe the hallmark of money in the new paradigm, to come full circle to where we started our conversation an hour ago. One of the characteristics of money in the new paradigm is going to be generosity. And that has to do with the system of flow. It's about giving. It's about not hoarding, not damming up the flow. And with these new systems of money, we didn't get to talk about them all in our call, but there are systems of money that promote generosity. Our current system promotes hoarding, and it promotes scarcity.
Mm-hmm.
But these other systems, if you read Charles Eisenstein's book, he talks quite a bit about them, and he's mapped out a system, a potential system for a new economy that's just brilliant. And he actually shows ways that we can create a new economy that fosters and enables and creates generosity and giving as part of it. And this is not airy-fairy
stuff.
It's
so fulfilling when we give. It's such an important aspect of our essence, isn't it?
it absolutely is. Virtually everybody on the planet knows that joy of giving. Whenever we've given something, something that has a profound impact on someone else, it can have us walking on air for days.
Mm-hmm.
And so why would we not want a money system that actually promotes the giving? Do we have another minute for me to say something about that?
Yes, absolutely. Just continue on. Even if we go a little over, that's fine.
Okay. Well, there's a money system that's talked about in both the books I mentioned, the New Money for a New World and Sacred Economics. There's a very important part of this money system that I feel is going to be birthed in the new era that's coming, and that's called negative interest, or it's also sometimes called demurrage. It's literally the opposite of the system we're using, which is money-based in interest. So what negative interest is that instead of hoarding money in a bank and being able to have it grow in time, it actually decreases in value in time. So if you give that just a moment's thought, you know, if you just ponder that principle for a moment or two, you see what that would mean to you. If you had money in a bank account and it was losing value in time, you'd want to give it, you'd want to spend it, you'd want to use it, you'd find ways to spend it, and if you couldn't spend it, you'd wind up giving it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not just some kind of airy-fairy, theory. It's been, these systems of negative interest or demurrage have actually been tried and tested and have been hugely successful in the world. And in fact, they've been so successful that when they've taken off, they've spread like wildfire, and the central banks were so worried, they were so scared that they were going to take over, that they crushed them. The central banks united with governments to crush these systems because
mm-hmm.
they knew, the central bankers and the politicians knew, that if they were allowed to take off, they would actually they would usurp the power. They would actually take over, and there would be no need for the system of money based in interest. Because the only people that are actually benefiting from this money based in interest now are the bankers and the very, very wealthy. So it's the what we're hearing in the news nowadays about the 1% versus the 99%.
Yes. And I'm so thrilled that this is coming to light through your conversation, Brad, and through these books, because the more we know about this, the more we will take our power back and won't let the government crush these new systems.
Yes, absolutely. And I also believe that, you know, they're already spreading so far and wide. We haven't had a chance to talk about it, but there are many forms of complementary currencies that are actually spreading around the world. And I believe that if it takes off enough, if these forms of other currencies take off enough, that it won't be able to be stopped because it'll just be too many people involved
mm-hmm.
in the system.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just share one more thing since we're on this topic that feels important about this, and that is how it's important that a money system actually reflect truth with a capital T.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at our current money system of money based in interest, it does not reflect truth. And the way that you can look at this is to look at how, you know, what money is. Money is basically an agreement. You know, it's an agreement of value. It's a way to put a value on something and say it's worth so much money. And so money is actually a representation of things in the material world, or services or things, goods, materials. And as such, if money is a metaphor or representation of material goods, you need to ask yourself, what kind of material goods in our world actually grow in value in time if you lock it away and put it in a closet in a, or in a bank.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can you think of anything? And the answer is no, there is nothing. There's nothing that you can name, no material good on the planet that grows in value in time if you lock it away in a bank. The closest thing you might come to would be gold. You know, it's a metal that never rusts, and virtually all metals rust, and, you know, food rots, food decays, clothes become moth-eaten. You know, all of these things decay with time. They don't gain value with time. Gold is the only metal that doesn't rust, and there are also precious gems, you know, diamonds and other precious gems that don't necessarily decay with time, but those don't gain in value; they simply stay the same. So, if you look at this principle, we've got a money system that is actually based in non-truth. It is based in the principle, it's based in the principle that things get more valuable with time. And the fact is that they don't. They actually decrease with value, decrease their value in time. And so we actually need to have a money system that reflects that basic truth of this material world that we're living in. And that is negative interest. It's demurrage. It's basically saying that, you know, you don't want to hoard your money. You want to use it. You want to share your money. You want to because if you don't, it's going to decrease in value and time.
Yes.
So anyway, I found that to be a very important principle to look at when we look at this new paradigm. We want to create systems that are sustainable. We want to create systems that reflect the truth of our world and the truth of consciousness. So that's a
very
that's
inspiring way to end, Brad.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Solanae. I wish we could talk for a very long time.
This opens up all new levels of conversation. This could be a very long conversation, and maybe we'll have you back again.
Well, that would be wonderful. And meanwhile, if people are interested, they can read those books that I mentioned.
Yes, absolutely. I highly recommend them.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. Definitely, it is time to embrace this new paradigm within and without.
It's the new paradigm of money is love. It's the new paradigm of generosity, the new paradigm of truth, of heart-centeredness, of loving and caring and giving.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
So may we manifest that.
Brad, thank you so much. It's been very wonderful, very inspiring, very informative. My listeners are going to be very grateful for this.
You're most welcome, and thank you for all the work you're doing. And may you inspire many to shift consciousness, and may we all together collaborate to manifest this new paradigm of heart-centered consciousness.
Amen. Amen.
Amen.
Oh, thank you, Brad.
Thank you, Solanae.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.